Shalom Hadavarnix. Welcome to our next session in the 12 Minor Prophets. We are now in session 28 as we work our way through the book of Micah. We're using material supplied by REL Ministries and developed by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum. Okay, well, let's review where we were last session. Last session, we started out in the tribulation period in chapter 2, verse 12. We saw that three nations would escape the influence of the Antichrist. That would be Edom, here to the south of Israel, then Moab, east of Israel, and Ammon, to the north of Israel. And all three of these nations lie in modern Jordan today. Edom is southern Jordan, modern southern Jordan. Moab is modern central Jordan. And Ammon is modern northern Jordan. So somehow, the nation of Jordan will escape the worst of the Antichrist domination. We also learned that the Jewish people had to flee to a city of refuge located in the wilderness and in the mountains. And just to the east of Israel, south and east there, is the Mount Seir mountain range, a wilderness, a mountainous wilderness with a very defendable location, Bozra. And as we looked at the map, we saw that the Mount Seir mountain range is located between Israel and Edom, just to the east side of the Jordan Valley. And in the middle of the Mount Seir mountain range is Bozra or Petra. Bozra or Petra. Excuse me, I shouldn't have said the Jordan River Valley. That's the Arabah. It towers over the Arabah. Now, Bozra Petra is a very, very defendable location. The main entrance is into Bozra is the Sikh, and it's a very narrow, winding entry canyon about a mile long. And as you can see, just a few soldiers could hold off an army as they tried to make their way through this entrance canyon. Here we see an aerial view of the exit of the Sikh. There's the exit of the Sikh. You can see the treasury carved into the wall of the mountain range on the left, and on the right at the bottom, those little dots are the people beginning to take their trek into Bozra. And to the top of the picture here, you can see the bowl in which Bozra sits. And the word Bozra, actually Bozra means sheepfold, because that's what a sheepfold is like. It's very narrow entrance, and then a large bowl on the inside where the sheep can find care and protection for the night. So Bozra is just like a sheepfold. Then from the tribulation, we moved in verse 13 to the second coming. And we learned that Yeshua would return initially to Bozra, and then he would break the siege, the Antichrist siege around the city. And then he would tread the winepress down into the wilderness of Paran, up through the Negev Desert, destroying the Antichrist armies, pushing them into the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea, and then approaching Jerusalem from the south. From the second coming, we enter chapter 3, and now we jump back to the prophet's present time, where he condemns Israel for her present sins, her present sinning. So this brings us now to chapters 4 and 5. Now the events of chapters 4 and 5 occur after the leadership of Israel, after the leadership of Israel leads the nation to accept the messiahship of Yeshua. All right, these are now Jewish believers, Messianic Jews. They've placed their faith in Yeshua. And so three lines of Messianism will develop. One, the Messianic program. Two, the Messianic people. And three, the Messianic person. So now we begin in chapter 4, verse 1, through chapter 5, verse 15, with the consolation of Israel. And again, we jump time frames from the prophet's present time, where he's condemning the nation. He jumps forward in time all the way past our time, future to us by quite a ways, I guess, into the kingdom. And we look at the first 8 verses of chapter 4 deals with the kingdom. So we'll be examining the Messianic program. So this is a very, very brief look at the kingdom. But this brief look in these few verses is the same message, exact same message that Micah's contemporary Isaiah was preaching Isaiah was delivering the exact same message. And when, so you have two contemporary prophets, Isaiah in Jerusalem, Micah in Moresh at Gath. We have two prophets repeating the same message. You better pay attention, because that's the biblical and Jewish way of emphasis, repetition. So here God says it twice, virtually identically. So let's see what Isaiah was preaching. Isaiah was preaching in chapter 2, verses 2 through 4. Now it will come about that in the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. And many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he will judge between nations, and will render decisions for many peoples. And they will hammer their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they learn war. So that's what Isaiah is preaching in Jerusalem. And here's Micah preaching the same message in Moresh at Gath. He begins with the establishment of the kingdom in chapter 4, verse 1. It will come about in the last days that the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and the peoples will stream to it. So he's talking here about the establishment of the kingdom, and this is in direct contrast to chapter 3, verse 12. In chapter 3, verse 12, we learn that the temple mount would be a plowed field. So chapter 3 related to Micah's present time, but chapter 4 now is relating to the kingdom. And he describes now the mountain of the Lord's house. Now the mountain of the Lord's house is a reference to millennial Mount Zion. And that millennial Mount Zion receives a full explanation and a detailed explanation in Ezekiel chapters 40 through 48. Well, we will just take a look at it in overview. If you want to look at this in detail, I would encourage you to take our Ezekiel class. So here we begin with the material we know about millennial Mount Zion. First of all, we know that it will be the highest mountain on the planet. All the other mountains will be lowered down. Millennial Mount Zion will be raised up. It will be topped by a 50-mile square plateau. Now, that plateau may not look as neat and clean as this diagram. I'm just doing a diagram. It may not look as neat and clean as this, but it will be 50 by 50. Now, from north to south, Millennial Mount Zion will be divided into three divisions. The northern division, 20 miles deep, the central division, 20 miles deep, the southern division, 10 miles deep. And then the southern division, from west to east, is also subdivided into three units, a 20-mile unit, a 10-mile unit, and a 20-mile unit. Now the buildings and etc. that are on top of Mount Zion consist of the temple and in the northern area. The temple will be 1 square mile in size, so it'll be quite a bit larger than the temple compound that we see today. So the temple will be in the northern area, and that northern area will be reserved as living area for the priests and the sons of Zadok. Now the central area will be reserved for the Levites, the assistants of the priests. They will live in that area. And the southern area will house millennial Jerusalem, which will be a city 10 miles by 10 miles. And then there'll be food growing areas to the east and the west of Jerusalem. Now, a very unique feature of Millennial Mount Zion is the Millennial River. It will flow out of the temple. It'll flow east to begin with, but then it will turn south and flow to Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, it will split into two major branches. One branch will go down to the Mediterranean Sea on the west. The other branch will go down to the Dead Sea on the east. Now, this is a map of Israel as it exists today. Now, this is the southern border of Israel in the kingdom. This is the southern border of Israel in the kingdom. Now, I've dropped a 50-square-mile cube, or 50-mile by 50-mile cube down on top of the map. And I've left Jerusalem in its place because the scripture says Jerusalem will be raised up in its place. So I'm leaving Jerusalem in its same location. And of course, the temple would be in the northern quadrant, or the northern third of the of Millennial Mount Zion. So we see how that's how Millennial Mount Zion will fit on the current geography. And that tells us that the Dead Sea will have to be modified. It'll still be visible so that the branch of the Millennial River can flow into it on the east. And the Mediterranean Sea will still be there, of course, on the west. But it looks like the coastline of Israel will have to bulge out a bit to accommodate Millennial Mount Zion. And of course, the Dead Sea will have to be probably smaller or it'll, to accommodate Millennial Mount Zion. So this means that there'll be very substantial geographic and changes, physical and geographic changes in planet Earth in order to accommodate Millennial Mount Zion. And that is totally consistent with the tribulation period. We know in the tribulation period there'll be massive earthquakes and shifting of the Earth's crust. The high mountains will be lowered down and Mount Zion will be raised up to be the highest mountain. So totally consistent with all the upheaval during the tribulation period. Planet Earth will look a bit different when we set up the kingdom. And here's a picture by a Messianic Jewish artist from Israel. I don't know if she's from Jerusalem, but from Israel. And this is a rendition of Jerusalem during the kingdom. And it's a very nice rendition. It shows the Shekinah glory around the city of Jerusalem. And that's what the scripture says. One of the five manifestations of the Shekinah glory in the kingdom will be as a wall of fire around Jerusalem. And there, of course, you can see Jerusalem on the top of Millennial Mount Zion. That's the idea of this picture. So it's a nice illustration. All right, so that's a quick look at the Millennial Mountain of the Lord's house. Again, more details in Ezekiel 40 through 48. So there'll be the kingdom will be established in verse 1. Then the instruction in the kingdom is highlighted in verse 2. Many nations will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us instruction, that he may teach us about his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For from Zion will go forth the law, even the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." So we learn here that there will be Gentile pilgrimages up to Jerusalem during the kingdom period. That's because Jerusalem will be the center of world attention. Now, Jerusalem is the center of world attention today, but it's not for good. It's because the nations hate Jerusalem. But then in the kingdom, Jerusalem will be the center of world attention for good. And the nations will look forward to come up and learn from the Jewish people all about millennial law, because Jerusalem will be the political, economic, and spiritual center of the world during the kingdom. And so the will of God will be decreed from Jerusalem. Now this will be millennial law, not Mosaic law. This will be the millennial law, which is a little different from Mosaic law. And here's another illustration by our same Jewish Christian artist of the Messianic kingdom. And you can see in up off in the north, there's Millennial Mount Zion and Millennial Jerusalem sitting upon it, glowing with the Shekinah glory, presence of the Lord. And, of course, in the foreground, you can see all the nations of the world sending delegations, streaming up to Jerusalem to learn the law of the Lord, the millennial law of the Lord. So things will be very different for Jerusalem in the Messianic kingdom. So there'll be an established kingdom, there'll be instruction in the kingdom, there'll be international peace during the Messianic kingdom. Micah 4:3. And he will judge between many peoples and render decisions for mighty distant nations. Then they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they train for war. And so the Messiah will settle all disputes between nations. You see, Yeshua will be personally reigning from Jerusalem with a rod of iron. What he says goes, and what he says will be just and right and good. But there will be disputes, apparently, in the kingdom for the Messiah to settle. But there'll be no need for weapons because the Messiah is settling disputes. So we won't have to spend our money on jet fighters anymore. And here's a picture of some Israel Air Force jet fighters. And we won't have to spend our money on the Merkavah tanks anymore. Those won't be needed. Those weapons will not be needed. Yeshua will take care of all of that. And in addition, this is something that's very personal to me. One of my favorite sections of Scripture is that there'll be no military training. Why? Because I'm a Vietnam veteran. I was trained for war. I went to a war zone, the Republic of Vietnam. Here's a picture of me with my helicopter. I was a helicopter crew chief with the 101st Airborne Division at Hue Phu Bai, South Vietnam. And I'm not ashamed of my military service or anything like that. But I will be very glad. This is when I was 20 years old. I turned 21 in Vietnam. But I will be very, very glad when young men, 20 and 21 years old, are not trained for war anymore the way I was trained. I look forward to that time when there is international peace during the kingdom. But not only international peace, there will be personal peace as well in verse 4. Each of them will sit under his vine and under his fig tree with no one to make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken. So there'll be prosperity and safety during the kingdom. See, the vine and the fig tree are symbols of personal peace, personal prosperity, and personal security. Peace, personal safety during the kingdom. And again, here's our messianic artist with an illustration of the peace and prosperity in the messianic kingdom. You see the clouds are sending down their rain. The crops are luxuriant and producing. The sower is overtaking the reaper. A time of plenty, a time of prosperity, a time of peace. I'm looking forward to the kingdom. So that's a quick overview of the kingdom. Just one more aspect remains, and that's the confession of Israel in chapter 4, verse 5. Though all the peoples walk each in the name of his God, as for us, we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. So everybody, all Israel, are believers, and Israel is determined to obey God regardless of what anyone else may do, whatever the other nations will do. And there will be a measure of rebellion in the kingdom. And just as there will be a measure of sin and measure of disputes, there will be a measure of rebellion. And we know that from the book of Revelation, where at the very end of the kingdom, Israel is surrounded, Jerusalem is surrounded by her enemies who have been deceived by Satan as he's been led out of the pit, and God dispenses with it very, very quickly, basically with a snap of his fingers. So there will be a measure of rebellion in the kingdom. And then that, of course, will usher in the eternal state where the sin issue is finished. We won't have to worry about the sin issue when we get to the eternal state. But anyway, this is very different from our past and our current history. In our past, what did we tend to do? Well, that's brought out in the book of 1 Samuel. This kind of sums it up, starting in 1 Samuel 8:5. They said to him, this is the leadership of the Jewish people, to him, that's Samuel, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations." And then once we get down to verses 19 and 20, you know, Samuel, the Lord says, if they don't want me, I won't rule over them. I will send a king over them. And so the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel when he said, this is a mistake. And they said, "No, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." And so God gave us a king prematurely. The true king that God wanted to rule over us was David, but we received a poor king, King Saul, preceding David, and we suffered for it. So, in our past, we wanted to be just like the nations around us. During the kingdom, we will not care. We want to be like God. We won't want a king over us like we wanted them. We will want God to rule us. See, in the past, we wanted a king, we wanted to worship their gods, we wanted to be just like them. And boy, did we suffer for it. We've learned our lesson finally in the kingdom. All right, so this is a summary of the Messianic program, and it will be fulfilled through the Messianic people. And that brings us to chapter 4, verse 6, through chapter 5, verse 1, where we look at the Messianic people. We begin with the restoration of Israel in verses 6 through 8. So the regathering is in chapter 4, verses 6 and 7. In that day, notice that, in that day, declares the Lord, I will assemble the lame and gather the outcasts, even those whom I have afflicted. I will make the lame a remnant and the outcasts a strong nation, and the Lord will reign over them in Mount Zion from now on and forever. So please note, the verse begins, in that day. What day? The day that verses 1 through 5 are fulfilled. We're talking about the kingdom here. In that day, during the kingdom, the people that God scattered, God will regather. That which was afflicted will be made strong. And the Lord will be their king, reigning over them from millennial Mount Zion in the person of Jesus the Messiah. The kingdom of Israel is described in verse 8. As for you, tower of the flock, hill of the daughter of Zion, to you it will come. Even the former dominion will come, the kingdom of the daughter of Jerusalem. Now the former kingdom was the Davidic kingdom and the Solomonic kingdom, but neither of these kingdoms ever reached millennial greatness. The Solomonic kingdom expanded to probably 75% of the territory promised to the Jewish people, but it never got 100% of the territory, and the people were not 100% righteous. So the former kingdom declined in quality, and finally was dispersed by the Assyrian and then by the Babylonian deportations. But now, God promises that sovereignty will be restored, and it will exceed the greatness of the former kingdoms. The greatness of this kingdom will exceed the greatness of the former kingdoms. Remember, in Bethlehem, the Messiah was born. In Jerusalem, the Messiah died. But Messiah's sovereignty over Israel will be restored. It'll be restored. But before the kingdom can come, there will be tribulation. And as we get to chapter 4, verse 9 through chapter 5, verse 1, we look at the tribulation prior to the restoration. So we were in the kingdom in verse 8. Now we jump back to the tribulation period. We backtrack to the tribulation period, the travail that will precede the kingdom. Then the travail is described in verses 9 and 10. Now, why do you cry out loudly? Is there no king among you? Or has your counselor perished? That agony has gripped you like a woman in childbirth? Writhe and labor to give birth, daughter of Zion, like a woman in childbirth. For now, you will go out of the city, dwell in the field, and go to Babylon. There you will be rescued. There the Lord will redeem you from the hand of your enemies. So we begin by learning that there's no king. And no king is a sign of divine displeasure. No Davidic king is over Israel at this time. And Israel is in travail. Now travail is a symbol of Israel in the tribulation before giving birth to the kingdom. This is brought out very clearly in Jeremiah 30, verses 4 through 7. Now these are the words which the Lord spoke concerning Israel and concerning Judah. For thus says the Lord, I have heard a sound of terror, of dread, and there is no peace. Ask now and see if a male can give birth. Why do I see every man with his hands on his loins as a woman in childbirth? And why have all faces turned pale? Alas, for that day is great. There is none like it. It is the time of Jacob's distress, but he will be saved from it. Time of Jacob's trouble, the time of Jacob's distress. So the key place that they're rescued from will be Babylon, according to verses 9 and 10. There will be a rescue from Babylon and a rescue from Jerusalem as well. Why? Because Babylon. Why Babylon? Babylon is the world capital during the tribulation. Remember, this is not 586 BC. We're talking about in that day, in verse 6. So during the tribulation, Babylon will be the world capital, and there will be Jewish people living there, and they will have to be rescued. They will have to be rescued. But there's also Jews who will be taken captive in Jerusalem, and their rescue is described in Zechariah 14, 2 through 5. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem for battle, and the city will be captured, and the houses plundered, the women ravished, and half the city exiled. But the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations, as when he fights on a day of battle. In that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which is in the front of Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives will be split in its middle from east to west by a very large valley, so that half the mountain will move toward the north and the other half toward the south, forming, I believe, the Valley of Jehoshaphat, by the way. You will flee by the Valley of My Mountains, for the Valley of the Mountains will reach to Azel. Yes, you will flee, just as you fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him. So that's the rescue of the Jews from Jerusalem as well. So after summarizing the coming travail, he now refers to the campaign of Armageddon itself. And so that's in chapter 4, verse 11 through chapter 5, verse 1. We begin by learning that all nations are going to come against Jerusalem. Micah 4:11. And now many nations have been assembled against you who say, let her be polluted. Let her eyes gloat over Zion. Now, this is not the only section of Scripture that discusses all the nations of the world coming against the Jewish people and Israel. Zechariah in Zechariah 12 and 14 also shares with us that the nations gather to annihilate the Jews once and for all. So let's take a look at Zechariah 12, verses 2 and 3. Behold, I am going to make Jerusalem a cup that causes reeling to all the peoples around. And when the siege is against Jerusalem, it will also be against Judah. It will come about in that day that I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the peoples. All who lift it will be severely injured, and all the nations of the earth will be gathered against it. And then in Zechariah 14, 1 and 2, the same message. Behold, the day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided among you. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be captured, the houses plundered, the women ravished, and half the city exiled. But the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city. So there will be Jewish people imprisoned in the city of Jerusalem that need to be rescued. So all nations have gathered against Jerusalem, and God has a purpose for that. They've gathered for their purpose to destroy the Jews, but God has his purpose in mind in verse 12. But they do not know the thoughts of the Lord. They do not understand his purpose. For he has gathered them like sheaves to the threshing floor. So God's purpose for gathering them is to destroy them. He's going to thresh them. That's the picture, drawing a threshing sledge over the wheat. And he is going to destroy them. That's a good picture of his destruction of their armies. So in verse 13, we come to the means of destroying them. Arise and thresh, daughter of Zion. For your horn I will make iron, and your hooves I will make bronze, that you may pulverize many peoples, that you may devote to the Lord their unjust gain and their wealth to the Lord of all the earth. So the means of destroying them is the Messianic people. Great, great losses will be inflicted on the Antichrist's armies as he sends his armies south from the Jezreel Valley down to Jerusalem to destroy it. Great losses will be inflicted on his army. However, nevertheless, in chapter 5, verse 1, Israel loses and needs to be rescued. Verse 1. Now muster yourselves in troops, daughter of troops. They have laid siege against us. With a rod they will smite the judge of Israel on the cheek. So notice there's a judge here, not a king. There's no king at this point. That's because there's a period of time when Israel will not have a king, the prophets teach us. This is not a reference to the last king, Zedekiah. This is a reference to a judge, a shofet. So this is not in Micah's present time or just after Micah's present time. This is in the tribulation, and then the judge is smitten. The word smite there shows his fall. Now this is not a messianic prophecy either. This is, has nothing to do with Jesus. This is the political leader over Israel during the tribulation period. So a summary of what's going to happen here. We will go through a three-point summary, but Zechariah 12 covers this in detail. So if you want to look and study all this in detail, go to Zechariah chapter 12. Go to our study on Zechariah. So a summary of what's happening here. All the nations are coming against Jerusalem. They're gathered in order that God may destroy them. They will suffer great losses at the hands of the Jews, at the hands of the Israel Defense Forces, but nevertheless, Israel falls. So the section ends badly. Israel will need to be rescued. And guess what? The rescuer is now introduced. Now this is a bad chapter break in the English. The Hebrew chapter break is better. Chapter 5 in the Hebrew starts in the next verse. But we are now in verse 2. So we take another Micah time jump to examine the concept of the messianic person in verses 2 through 15 of chapter 5. First of all, we deal with his origin. And two origins are stated for the messianic person. So we're in the tribulation. Now we're going to jump back to the first coming in the first part of chapter 5, verse 2. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you one will go forth for me to be ruler over Israel. So the first part of Micah 5, 2 speaks of the Messiah's human origin. He'll be born as a baby in Bethlehem. But he comes unto me, unto God. He comes to fulfill the purpose of God. All right, now we're at the first coming in chapter 5, verse 2, first part of the verse. But now, in the second part of the verse, we jump to the distant past. We jump into eternity past. His goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity. And this speaks of the pre-existence of the Messiah. He existed before the creation of the world. And these are the strongest possible Hebrew terms for eternity past. Similar words like this are used of God. For example, Psalm 90, verse 2. Before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. And then Proverbs 8, 22 and 23. For the Lord possessed me at the beginning of his way, before his works of old. From everlasting I was established, from the beginning, from the earliest times of the earth. So the Messiah's existence precedes his physical birth. It precedes the physical world, in fact. And so we learn here that from Micah 5, 2, that the messianic person will be the God-man. He will have a divine nature and a human nature. And again, Isaiah, Micah's contemporary, teaches the exact same thing in Jerusalem. Again, when this is repeated, pay attention to it. It's the biblical way of emphasis, repetition. So let's take a look at Isaiah 9, 6, and 7. For a child will be born to us. That's his humanity. A son will be given to us. That's a reference to his deity. And the government will rest on his shoulders. That's a reference to his human ministry. Now his character is brought out. And his name will be called Wonderful Counselor. By the way, that word wonderful is only used of God. Mighty God, that's used of God only. Eternal Father, boy, there's no question there. Prince of Peace. His character is deity, even though he has the responsibility for human government. But notice, his human government has a divine aspect to it as well, because there will be no end to the increase of his government or peace. And, you know, the governments of human beings have an end. The king dies, the dictator dies, whoever dies, and usually peace doesn't last very long. But with the Messiah, there will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it, with justice and righteousness from then on and what? Forevermore. That's divine. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. So this only can describe the God-man, the messianic God-man, a man with a divine nature and a human nature. Now, his relationship to Israel is discussed in verse 3. But from chapter 5, verse 2, we jump forward back to the tribulation period in chapter 5, verse 3, first part of the verse, with his relationship to Israel. Therefore, he will give them up until the time when she who is in labor has borne a child. So he's going to give them up. This is the result of the rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus by the Jewish leadership back in the first century when Yeshua came and presented himself. When he's rejected, Yeshua separates himself from Israel until Israel is nationally regenerated, until the time when every living Jewish man, woman, and child places their faith in him. And Israel has been travailing until the end of the tribulation period. She's going to be in travail. So this Yeshua is going to give them up until the travailing is finished. And this is a reference back to chapter 4, verses 9 and 10, Israel going through the tribulation period. And Israel will be saved through Jewish leaders calling on Yeshua to return. We have to call on him to return. And the results of Israel's return to the Lord is in chapter 5, second part of verse 3, and verse 4. Here, he moves into the second coming and the kingdom. They're kind of conflated together here. It's hard to distinguish the two, one from the other. 3, starting with the second part of verse 3. Then the remainder of his brethren will return to the sons of Israel. And he will rise and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they will remain, because at that time, he will be great to the ends of the earth. The Messiah will be the ruler of the world. So, in verses 5, 3b through 4, we see a unification of Israel and Judah in verse 3. And then we see the administration of the Messiah over Israel in verse 4. So he'll be reading and ruling and feeding his people. That's what a shepherd does, by the way. And he'll be doing that with justice and righteousness and with knowledge and understanding. All right, I've placed a question up on the screen. A debate rages between Jewish believers or believers in Jesus and the rabbis. And the debate is over this question. Is Micah 5:2 messianic? Is this a messianic prophecy? Well, let's see what the rabbis say about it. A number of them feel it is messianic in nature. And so here's some rabbinic support for the fact that Micah 5:2 is messianic. Rabbi Kimke, well-known Jewish commentator. He says, out of thee shall come forth unto me a judge to be ruler in Israel, and this is the King Messiah. So in Micah 5:2, he very specifically says, this refers to King Messiah. Targum Jonathan to the Prophets paraphrases Micah 5:2 in this way. And you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, you who are too small to be numbered among the thousands of the house of Judah, from you shall come forth before me the Messiah to exercise dominion over Israel, he whose name is mentioned from before, from the days of creation. So that's the paraphrase of the Targumim, of the Targum there, and the paraphraser saw Micah 5:2 as speaking of the Messiah. Now, Targum Palestine, another one of the Targumim. Here's this paraphrase. Out of thee, Bethlehem, shall Messiah go forth before me to exercise dominion over Israel. In addition to that, Dr. Alfred Edersheim, he's a Messianic Jewish scholar of the late 1800s, he makes the same point, and this is in his book, Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, by the way, which is another book you should have in your library. He makes the same point that this is messianic in nature and refers the reader to Pirkei, the Rabbi Eliezer. So he's come across a rabbinic support for Micah 5:2 as being messianic as well. And of course, we see it We see the verse as fulfilled in Yeshua, Matthew 2, 1 through 6. Now after Yeshua was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east, and we've come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Gathering together all the chief priests and the scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They said to him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for this is what has been written by the prophet," it's the prophet Micah, chapter 5, verse 2, "And you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, are by no means least among the leaders of Judah, for out of you shall come forth a ruler who will shepherd my people, Israel." So it's fulfilled in Yeshua. And by the way, let's review our four interpretive techniques. Remember, we've looked at this before. We've looked at the rabbinic term, the usage, and the example. The four interpretive techniques, how the New Testament uses Old Testament prophecy. Okay, the techniques it uses. Number one is called the Peshat by the rabbis. This means the plain sense, the literal sense of the verse. And we will call it a literal prophecy plus a literal fulfillment, Matthew 2, 5, and 6. And by the way, this is the most important interpretive technique to use. And the rabbis agree. We read in the Talmud, Shabbat 63a, Yevamot 11b, and 24a, we read, "A text cannot be taken from the meaning of its peshat." A text cannot be taken from the meaning of its plain literal sense. And Rabbi Acharon Feldman, in his book The Juggler and the King, agrees. He says, "The simple meaning of the text is always true." Good for you, Rabbi Feldman. And this is simply another way of saying the golden rule of interpretation. The golden rule of interpretation begins with the statement, "When the plain sense of Scripture makes common sense, seek no other sense." So that's basically an affirmation of the importance of Peshat. The second technique, the rabbis called Remez, this is the allegorical or philosophical technique. We would call it a literal prophecy plus a typical fulfillment. Now, what's a type? What's a typical fulfillment? Well, a type is a figure, a representation, or a symbol of something to come, as an event in the Old Testament foreshadows another in the New Testament. And this is a biblical concept. So that's why we call this a literal prophecy plus a typical fulfillment, Matthew 2:15 in this case. The third type of technique is called a drash. This is the agadic or the homiletical or the practical application of the text. So we would call it a literal prophecy plus application, Matthew 2:17 and 18 as an example. And finally, the fourth technique is the sod. The mystical approach. And when we come across a sod, that's a summation. We call it a summation, Matthew 2:23. And I hope you notice that all four of these techniques are valid because the Holy Spirit led Matthew to use all four techniques in Matthew chapter 2. All these examples come out of Matthew chapter 2. Well, what are we talking about here? Here we're talking about a peshat, a literal prophecy plus a literal fulfillment, Micah 5:2, the birth of the Messiah in Bethlehem, and by gum, he was born in Bethlehem. So one-on-one, a literal prophecy plus a literal fulfillment. Now, not everybody agrees with the rabbis we cited or with us, so there are Jewish objections to the fact that this is considered messianic. So let's take a look at some of these positions. Now, that the verse is messianic is the position of the Sanchino books of the Bible. This is a well-known classic Jewish commentary on the Bible. And so Micah chapter 5 is summarized with this statement in the Sanchino books of the Bible on Micah. "It is a prophecy of the messianic king and Israel's destiny among the nations." So Sanchino books of the Bible has a number of statements affirming that this is a messianic verse. Verses 1 through 5 in the commentary are entitled "The Messianic King." Regarding the phrase "from Ancient of Days," it is possible that the phrase gave birth to the later Jewish doctrine that the Messiah existed in the mind of God from time immemorial as part of the Creator's plan at the inception of the universe. That's a nice statement by the rabbi. And he didn't know it, but he was pretty much speaking New Testament doctrine there. In the Talmud, the Sanchino Books of the Bibles goes on. In the Talmud, the name of the Messiah is included among the seven things created before the world was brought into being. Well, that sounds like Colossians 1, 15 through 19, doesn't it? He, Yeshua, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created. See, he predated creation. For by him all things were created, both the heavens and the earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. He's part of the creation. He's the one who did it. All things were created through him and for him. He is before all things. And in him all things hold together. He is also the head of the body, the church. And he is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he himself will come to have first place in everything. For it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness to dwell in him. So the rabbis got it pretty close there. You know, they don't always get things right, but they got it pretty close there. Okay, the biggest objection, and the only objection I've been able to run across, is this objection. The verse is fulfilled in King Hezekiah. King Hezekiah is the Messiah. And we read this in the Talmud, Sanhedrin 99a. And by the way, you will find contradictory opinions in rabbinic writings. Rabbi Hillel said, Rabbi Hillel is a very famous first century rabbi. Rabbi Hillel said, "There shall be no Messiah for Israel because they have already enjoyed him in the days of Hezekiah." So Rabbi Hillel said, no Messiah is coming. By the way, Rabbi Hillel could very well have been one of the rabbis that discussed Bible and spiritual things with the young Messiah, the 13-year-old Messiah, when he was in Jerusalem. Rabbi Hillel lived right around that time. That would be very interesting. I would have liked to have seen what that discussion, if that happened, the discussion between Rabbi Hillel and the Messianic person. If Rabbi Hillel says the Messiah came and previously, he was Hezekiah. The Messiah was Hezekiah, and I can see Jesus saying, "Oh yeah." Well, our response: Hezekiah is not a very good candidate for messiahship at all. He was a good king, a good man, but he definitely was not the Messiah. And by the way, Rabbi Joseph in Sanhedrin 99a would agree. This phrase follows the statement by Hillel. Rabbi Joseph said, "May God forgive him for saying so." In other words, may God forgive Hillel for saying that Hezekiah was the Messiah. So the positions that Micah 5:2 speaks of the Messiah are very, very consistent throughout the Jewish writings. So we agree. We agree. Micah 5:2 is fulfilled in Yeshua. Of course, the rabbis would not agree with that. They would, but how do they explain? How do they explain Micah 5:2 then? All right, because no Jewish person is being born in Bethlehem these days. Bethlehem today is a Muslim city. There are no Jews living in Bethlehem today. It's in the West Bank, and Arab Christians are being driven out by fundamentalist Muslims. In fact, Bethlehem now is a hotbed of Islamic fundamentalism. So how can you have a Messiah born in Bethlehem when there's no Jews living there? But anyway, that could always change, I suppose. All right, well, let's get off this discussion. Let's get back to the establishment of peace by the Messianic person in chapter 5, verses 5 through 15. So now in verse 4, we were in the second coming in the kingdom. Now we jump back in chapter 5, verse 5, to chapter 7, verse 10, a large section on that tribulation, a large section on that travail that will precede the coming of the kingdom. So we begin with the fact that the Messianic person will defend Israel from her enemies in verses 5 and 6. This one will be our peace. When the Assyrian invades our land, when he tramples on our citadels, then we will raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 leaders of men. They will shepherd the land of Assyria with the sword, the land of Nimrod at its entrances, and he will deliver us from the Assyrian when he attacks our land and when he tramples our territory. So the context, again, is not Micah's present time. The context is the tribulation time. The Assyrian here is a title for the Antichrist. Now, why he's called this, we don't know. Because we know from Daniel 9:26 he'll be of Roman origin. So we'll have to see exactly how this unravels. But then, when the Antichrist enters the land to meet the Messiah, he will be totally defeated. Israel will raise against him 7. That speaks of completeness. And 8 speaks of one extra. So the forces to come against the Assyrian will be more than enough, more than complete. And he will be defeated. Now remember, Assyria was not defeated by Israel in Micah's day. Assyria was not defeated by Israel in Micah's day. Assyria was not defeated by Israel. The northern kingdom was totally deported by the Assyrians, and the southern kingdom was devastated by the Assyrians. Only Jerusalem survived. The kingdom did survive. So this is Antichrist. This is Antichrist. So Israel will be defended from her enemies, and she'll be overpowered to overcome these enemies in verses 7 through 9. And they'll do that through two kinds of ministry. Then the remnant of Jacob will be among many peoples like dew from the Lord, like showers on vegetation, which do not wait for man or delay for the sons of men. The remnant of Jacob will be among the nations, among many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forests, like a young lion among the flocks of sheep, which, if he passes through, tramples down and tears. There's none to rescue. So there'll be two types of ministry engaged in by the Jewish people. Verse 9. Your hand will be lifted up against your adversaries, and all your enemies will be cut off. So there's a destruction of the Antichrist, destruction of the enemies of Israel. And again, as I was saying, there'll be two kinds of ministry that the Jewish people will engage in. First of all, a ministry of dew. They'll engage in a spiritual ministry. That's a gentle, nurturing ministry for the submissive, for those who survive the tribulation. And this is for the believing Gentiles and who survive the tribulation. They'll be nurtured by the Jewish people, but they will be like a lion. A lion brings power and judgment for those who are rebellious. So there'll be establishment of peace. Messiah will defend Israel from enemies. They will be empowered to overcome their enemies. And then Israel will be purged. Israel will be purged of a number of items. And this will be good. Because first of all, Israel will be purged of weapons. In verse 10, in that day, declares the Lord, I will cut off your horses from among you and destroy your chariots. So we won't need to spend any more money on Merkava tanks. This is a modern chariot that won't be needed when the messianic person defends Israel. We won't need the Merkava anymore. All right, we'll be also purged of fortified cities in verse 11. And I will also cut off the cities of your land and tear down your fortifications. So there'll be no need for any kind of security fences anymore. We have a number of security fences around Israel today. Most of them are barbed wire with sensors. This is the Gaza Strip security fence. It won't be necessary. This wall of electronic and wire wall will not be necessary in the kingdom. This is the West Bank security barrier. Again, it's a wall made up of wire and sensors and a road. So this is, by the way, the vast majority of the security barrier, the security fence. But part of it is these high concrete walls. And of course, when you see pictures of the security barrier in the news, that's all they show because this is the most impressive part of the security barrier. But the high concrete sections only make up maybe 10% or less, something like 10% or less of the security barrier. And they are only erected in areas where they will protect Jewish people from snipers. These are actually sniper walls, anti-sniper walls. But they won't be needed either. We won't need anti-sniper walls. And then there's an Egyptian security barrier as well along the border with Egypt. When I was in Israel, 1994, I believe it was, we were down in the Sinai. And the only thing between Egypt and Israel was a barbed wire fence. It was hardly anything. But look at it today. There's a wire fence. What is the name of that wire on the top? A barbed wire on the top, razor wire on the top. There's sensors, security roads. It's really a pretty sophisticated barrier today. It won't be needed. It won't be needed. So that'll be good. So the fortifications will be gone. In verse 12, the occult will disappear from Israel. I will cut off sorceries from your hand, and you will have fortune tellers no more. And you know, this kind of stuff is prevalent in Israel today through the Kabbalah, through Jewish mysticism. This is an article from the Jerusalem Post in 2004 called Kabbalah for Cash. And what does the writer, Matty Wagner, write in his article? He says, for new Israeli shekels, 1,200, you can get a set of Zohar. That's the Zohar, that book there. That's the mystical book of the ultra-Orthodox. And if you don't buy one now, you're giving the evil inclination a chance to influence you. Just a few drops of spiritual light from the Zohar will bring you material plenty. There we go. This is superstition. The books don't even have to physically arrive to your house. The fact that you've bought them is enough for material prosperity to start. Man, this sounds like the name it and claim it prosperity gospel that's in Christianity. And you can get silver and gold Kabbalah, healing power rings, protection rings. This is pure superstition. Polo shirts with Kabbalah letters on them, incense, red thread. You can buy Kabbalah red thread that negates the evil eye. Pure superstition, you guys. You can buy Kabbalah water. Why? What's so important about Kabbalah water? It has pristine molecules that are shaped like the Magen David. Regular water can create chaos, but this water provides protection. You can also buy Pinhas water, which has medicinal qualities. On top of that, you can buy 44 types of amulets, and there's some samples right there. Amulets to bring health and help you find a mate and fertile for children and ensure financial success. You see, nobody's depending on the Lord here. They're depending on superstition, on a piece of tin, a piece of metal, a piece of gold, a piece of silver to bring creativity and protection and cultivate love, etc., etc., etc. This is just pure superstition. Another superstition that will be gone from Israel. In 2004, there was an article on sage worship. Here's what the writer wrote. The name of the article was "The Heavens Are Opened." Here's what he wrote. Rabbi Yaakov Yisrael Ifergan, and that's a picture of Rabbi Ifergan there, is tossing candles into the furnace. The candles are offerings to the tzaddikim. They're not making offerings to God. They're making offerings to righteous men, righteous sages, so that they might intercede with God and answer the prayers of all those present. Sounds like Roman Catholic sainthood, saint worship, same kind of idea. Because of the rabbi's efforts, the heavens are open. The tzaddikim are receiving our prayers, the MC shouts. You have to go through an intermediary. You can't go directly to God, huh? And also, Rabbi Avigdor Miller takes his shot at this, too, because he was ultra-Orthodox in nature. In his book, Rejoice, O Youth, on pages 208 and 209, he writes, after the destruction of the sanctuary, the special presence of God, which once dwelt in the Holy of Holies, now rests on the sages who teach the Torah to disciples. Brachot 8a. Even when the divine presence dwelt in the sanctuary, it was only because of the Torah sages. They are the bond between God and Israel because they bear the oral tradition, not the Mosaic law here, the oral tradition for which God made his covenant with us. Any form of contact with the sages, this is sage worship, you guys, any form of contact with the sages and support of the sages is tantamount. It's the same as contact with God. In other words, he's made the sages divine. Now, in regard to Yeshua, on page 36, he writes, the writings of the Nazarene's followers state clearly that all the sages of the Jews opposed them. Not even a single man of learning supported them. Well, he's wrong there. Nicodemus supported them. The Nazarenes state also in their writings that their only adherents were some of the most ignorant and persons of the lowest class. And I'm sure he considers fishermen ignorant, and I'm sure he considers Matthew the tax collector the lowest class possible. Even among them, the vast majority opposed the Nazarenes. The writings of the Nazarenes' followers concede that the sages rebuked him and his followers for violating the law of the Torah. Well, Jesus violated the oral law over and over and over again because he saw it as voluntary. He never violated the Mosaic law. The Mosaic law is from God. The oral law is from man. But of course, the ultra-Orthodox would disagree with me heartily. So his point, Rabbi Miller's point, the Orthodox theology of sage worship, supporting the sages is tantamount supporting God. The Orthodox theology of sage worship justifies the rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus in the first century and today. That's going to be gone, folks. When Yeshua is reigning and has purged Israel, he'll purge us of the occult. Finally, he'll purge us of idolatry in verses 13 and 14. I will cut off your carved images and your sacred pillars from among you so that you will no longer bow down to the work of your hands. I will root out your asherim from among you and destroy your cities. So this is all going to be gone. It's back, however. It's back in modern Israel. Here's some women dancing up on the Golan Heights, and there's the little idol that they are praising. Here's the caption from Biblical Archaeology Review. Potter Daphne Zuckerman replicated a clay figurine, thought to be that of a goddess. For about half an hour they danced while the leader recited a prayer thanking the goddess, not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but thanking the goddess for the forces of life, fertility, and peace. In other words, idol worship, I'm back. Idol worship is back in the land. That'll be gone. That'll be gone in the kingdom. And God will bring vengeance upon the Gentiles, verse 15. I will execute vengeance and anger and wrath on the nations which have not obeyed. So God will execute judgment on Israel's enemies. So ends section number 2, the condemnation and consolation of Israel. Israel's consolation comes through three lines of messianism: the messianic program, fulfilled through the messianic people, by means of the messianic person. Well, we're out of time for today, and we'll pick it up next session with a theme and application chart dealing with chapter 4, verse 1 through chapter 5, verse 15. We'll ask some questions dealing with some of the ideas we have encountered in this section of the study. So, thanks so much for being part of our study. We will see you next session. Lahithra'ot.